for the peace of the world and the benefit and freedom of the Iraqi people, I hereby give the order to execute Operation Iraqi Freedom. I knew the consequences my order would bring. I had wept with the widows of troops lost in Afghanistan. I had hugged children who no longer had a mom or dad. I did not want to send Americans into combat again, but I had vowed to do what was necessary to protect the country.
When no weapons of mass destruction were found, you write in Decision Points that it gave you a sickening feeling and still does.
True. Well, let me walk you back a little bit. One, everybody thought Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The intelligence service, many people who became critics of the war later on felt he had weapons of mass destruction, and that we had to view Saddam Hussein differently after 9/11. That when you saw a threat, you could not let it fully materialize. And the threat that he represented as a sworn enemy of the United States was to give weapons of mass destruction to an enemy that had just attacked us. And so a lot of people were concerned about it. And when we didn't find weapons, I felt terrible about it and sick about it and still do, because a lot of the case in removing Saddam Hussein was based upon weapons of mass destruction.
We wouldn't have gone to war had there not been a case for weapons of mass destruction.
Well, he was a threat. The interesting thing that happened after he was removed is they sent, we had a team of inspectors go in who reported that he was equally dangerous. We may not have found the vials, but he had the capacity to make weapons. Here's the point I make in this book. Oftentimes history judges you on the decisions you make, but a lot of times they don't judge you on the decision you don't make. And the point I make is that Saddam Hussein in power today would mean the world would be less stable and more dangerous, and 25 million Iraqis would be living under the thumb of a brutal, ruthless dictator. My point is the world's better with him gone.
But yet you would not have made the decision.
Well, I don't think that's a question I cannot answer, because I didn't have that luxury. In other words, the decision I made was based upon what everybody thought was solid intelligence.
Do you now feel or believe that you were misled?
No, I don't think so.
By your intelligence?
Not at all.
You do not?
No, not at all. I think our intelligence...
What happened?
Just we're wrong. I don't think anybody intentionally... Misled is a wrong word. Do I think that we made a mistake? Do I think we were wrong in our assessment? Yeah, I tell you what was wrong. It's Saddam Hussein deceived everybody. Saddam Hussein, it turns out, did not want people to know that he didn't have weapons of mass destruction, including many people in his own administration. Which was strange, because I made it clear that let the inspectors in or else we'll remove you from power. And he didn't believe me, sadly.
4,421 of our troops now gone.
Yeah.
How heavily does that weigh on you?
Well, it weighs heavily, because I know that the decision I made disrupted somebody's life in a big way. And it would weigh more heavily on me, however, if I had have cared more about my political standing and less about completing the mission.
You talk about the woman Val, where you met with her. Yes.
She wrote me a note. I met her kids, and I'm kind of a weeper, as you may be able to tell. And I did everything I could not to weep in front of her children, because I wanted her children to have the memory of the commander-in-chief saying, "Your father's a hero, not a weepy commander-in-chief." So I fought back the tears, and she handed me a note that said, "John did his job, now you do yours."
We'll be right back.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere. Nope, no weapons over there. Maybe under here. Oops, this photo wasn't supposed to be in here. This is a skull and bone secret signal.
Live and at large, it's the one 9/11 mystery that endures. World Trade Center Building number 7.
hear that?
Keep your eye on that building. It'll be coming down soon.
They were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull. And then we watched the building collapse.
And so the first one was likely an accident, the second one was an attack, and the third was a declaration of war.
The publication of the Bush memoir fills in some of what we did not know about 9/11. But no official account so far addresses the issue now being raised in an extraordinary ad campaign.
I lost my son.
My nephew.
My uncle.
My son.
On September 11th, 2001.
Most people don't know that a third tower fell on September 11th.
World Trade Center 7, a 47-story skyscraper, was not hit by a plane.
Although the official explanation is that fire brought down Building 7.
Over 1,200 architects and engineers have looked into the evidence
and believe there is more to the story.
Up until now, only those considered nut jobs questioned the official conclusion that office fires caused by the nearby catastrophe of the towers collapsing brought down building number 7.
But I do believe that it is the first time in history that fire has ever melted steel. I do believe that it defies physics for the World Trade Center Tower 7, Building 7, which collapsed in on itself. It is impossible for a building to fall the way it fell without explosives being involved.
And if explosives were involved, that would mean that the most obnoxious protesters in recent years are right. If you hear the shouting, it's a group of demonstrators who've come. 9/11 was an inside job. Oh, get a life. Get a life. 9/11 was an inside job.
Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Geraldo Rivera, and that noisy demonstration was more than 2 years ago. But the folks behind that TV ad you saw earlier are not so easy to dismiss as those demonstrators were. And what caught my eye is their claim that more than 1,300 architects and engineers examined the evidence about Building 7's collapse and disagree with the official report issued by the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Before we examine what they have, this heads up. Also tonight, we probe the remorseless Randall Moore, the creep who raped and murdered his own wife and then outrageously taunted her family at his sentencing. And we're live tonight on the bloody Mexico border, the most dangerous place on earth right now. Those stories coming up. But up front tonight, Building 7 was no ordinary building. Among other key tenants, including several intelligence and law enforcement agencies, it also housed New York City's Emergency Operations Center, known as Mayor Giuliani's bunker. Here to tell us what they know about its collapse and why they question the official conclusions are Bob McElvain, whose son died in the World Trade Center, and Tony Zambotti, a mechanical engineer. Nice to see you guys. Welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Nice to meet you, Geraldo.
Our condolences, obviously, for your loss. But Tony, let me start with you. You're an engineer. Are you suggesting that the official account that Building 7 collapsed because of the fire melting the steel or in some other ways, destroying the integrity, the structural integrity of the building, that's false? You think that's false?
Yes, I do. And for a couple reasons. One is that Building 7 came down. It went into a sudden collapse across the full width and length of the building for 2.25 seconds, which amounted to 105 feet or eight stories, eight 13-foot tall stories. It was in full free-fall acceleration. That is impossible because in a natural collapse, columns would have to buckle. When columns buckle, there is a minimum resistance. It's asymptotic, if you know what that means. That means it never goes to zero. So it's impossible. You can't reach.
So here's what, I guess in layman's terms, just get my hands here, Peter. So what he's saying is that the top floor collapses, hits the next floor, hits the next floor, hits the next floor. So it's bang, 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 bang. The weight of the upper floors.
It would slow down. What I'm trying to say is it was in full free fall acceleration. All of its potential energy was being converted to motion.
Instead of what I just described, the thing just collapsed like a pancake.
It just came down.
And so what are you suggesting brought it down, Tony?
I'm suggesting there was some form of demolition devices in that building for eight stories or more.
You think that the explosives brought down Building 7?
Some form of demolition device. I'm not pretending to know what it is. I am saying that it was in free-fall acceleration.
All right, let me ask you this.
The NASD admitted to that.
Okay, let me ask you this before I get to Dad, before I get to Bob here. We've all seen old, obsolete buildings and public housing in other places outlive their usefulness, being demolished by the professionals who can actually collapse a building right in its own footprint. That's what it looks like happened to Building 7. Do you believe that's what happened?
Yes, I do believe that's what happened.
And why do you think they're lying about it?
I don't really know all the details of what they're lying about. I can't read their minds. All I can say is, scientifically, it does not, it's impossible for fire to have done what we see.
And these, Bob, these 1,300 engineers and architects who agree with you and some of the other relatives' families, I know you found your son just a couple of days after the disaster, he was outside. I don't want to get into the details of how you believe he died, but these architects and engineers, do they support your contention? Do you believe that it was an inside job, that 9/11 was an inside job?
I believe it was an inside job. Okay, I'm here.
You believe our government?
Right. Wait, look, please. But the thing is we don't have enough time to get into the reasons of that. We set up this Building What campaign. We saw the
Building What.
Building What dot org.
Buildingwhat.org.
The reason we have that is
website.
Because Judge Lehner, when we petitioned, we had a petition to have a new investigation in New York City about Building 7, and when the lawyers.
And you're asking the New York City Council. I don't
right.
want to interrupt also to
right.
reopen.
So I know we don't have the time, but anyway, he said, Building what? Because no one has any idea about Building 7. So because I believe in, I've talked to so many firemen, so many EMS workers, policemen, who talk about the explosions. And I know you don't want to get into my son, but I feel my son died from an explosion. I went to all the 9/11 commission hearings. I've been researching this for 9 years.
So what and do you want? Let's get to the bottom line
I want truth. I've been lied to. I mean, it's beyond a reasonable doubt that the 9/11 Commission did not tell this story.
9/11 Commission barely mentioned Building 7, if at all.
Right.
Okay, what forum do you want the investigation in?
Well, the forum, what we wanted is in New York City right now, because New York City, we feel, has an obligation to investigate 9/11.
So before we're out of time completely, Bob, do you want specifically the New York City Council to open its own investigation of the Building 7 collapse?
Absolutely.
And that would satisfy you if they did that?
Well, I'm not done. I'm still a parent. I'm a parent who has an obligation to find out why my son was murdered.
I'm after that.
As far as this show and New York City, I want the investigation. That will not be sufficient
enough.
Not
heal your wound. I get that.
And I'm going beyond that.
But it's the
that.
Beginning.
But of course it's the beginning, but that's why I support this Building What campaign.
Bob McElveen, we thank you. Tony Zimbardi, thank you very much. It is an intriguing topic. I certainly am much more open-minded about it than I was, and it is because of the involvement of the 9/11 families and all these engineers and architects. Clearly, they know more than I do. Thanks, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Lauer. Thanks for joining us. His memoir is called Decision Points, and indeed America will be living with some of his decisions for decades to come. President George W. Bush came to Washington amid protests, guided the country through tragedy, and more than once stirred controversy. Now, over the course of two wide-ranging conversations, the former president speaks about it all, extremely candid about his best and toughest times, starting with day one. I want to take you to Inauguration Day 2001 in January. What were your thoughts? What were your expectations of that day?
I knew it would be an emotional moment, and a moment of high honor. And I wanted to start trying to unite the country after a very divisive election.
You're in the motorcade, and you write about this.
Yeah.
You and Mrs. Bush are heading to the White House, and there are protesters.
Yeah, a lot of them.
And they're holding signs with foul language, and they're giving you the middle finger salute. And some of those signs say, Hail to the Thief.
Yeah.
And they're throwing eggs.
Yeah. This crowd of activists were, trying to disrupt and ruin the inaugural parade for others.
You're right about you're in the limo and they got that bulletproof glass, which takes some of the sound out.
But it looks like a pantomime, yes. It was interesting. And I put it in there just to give people a sense for what the environment was like when I became president.
The Florida recount. Hanging chads, the divided Supreme Court. George Bush had a rough road to the White House. A road made rougher, he admits, by his own missteps.
It was a Tuesday, September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
You're at a school in Florida.
I was listening to children read their books.
Ready? Yes, King. Get ready? King.
It was a scheduled appearance to promote education reform. He already knew one plane had hit the World Trade Center, but thought it was an accident. Then his chief of staff whispered in his ear.
And Andy says, a second plane is at the World Trade Center. America's under attack.
That videotape of you sitting there, and now that we know in hindsight you had just been given that news and you sat there, and it was 7 minutes.
Yeah, that's right. And I made the decision not to jump up and kind of create a chaotic scene because people are going to be watching my reaction.
And yeah, and it's also in the eye of the beholder because the supporters of George Bush look at those 7 minutes on tape and say he was trying to show an air of calm. The critics of George Bush say he was in shock.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to debate the critics as to whether or not I was in shock or not. I wasn't. And they can read the book and they can draw their own conclusion.
He made a brief statement at the school.
Terrorism against our nation will not stand.
Then he and his staff boarded Air Force One.
You said, let's go back to Washington. And they didn't let you. Can you not overrule them at that period?
I can, but there is an issue of the continuity of government.
And so Air Force One stayed away from the Capitol, flying first to Louisiana, then Nebraska, while incredibly, President Bush found it hard to get a reliable phone connection to Washington.
So I'm on Air Force One that had a communication system that was antiquated.
Yeah, I was surprised to read that.
I was surprised that it was the case. And I was getting fleeting glimpses of the news as we went from TV market to TV market. I watched these buildings collapse from Air Force One, and it was a very emotional moment for all of us, not just me, but for everybody involved.
You gave an order at some point during that morning. There was still chaos.
Yeah.
Nobody knew if there were other planes. And you had to give an order that the U.S. military had the authority to shoot down any plane, whether it was a Cessna or a commercial airliner, that did not respond to commands to land.
Right. We had made the decision to clear the skies of all aircraft. The only safe course of action was to say, no airplanes, and any airplane that shows up that does not respond to fighter escort would get shot down.
In fact, when Flight 93 went down in that field in Shanksville, there was a time where you didn't know whether that plane had gone down because of your order.
I had a sickening feeling. And then I found out that it 93 had gone down because of the heroism of some Americans. I mean, truly an heroic act to storm the cockpit, to bring down the plane to save others' lives.
He got back to Washington that evening, a city and a country forever changed.
A couple of days after 9/11, you gave a speech at the National Cathedral.
We are here in the middle hour of our grief.
But as you stood there delivering this powerful and important speech,
yeah,
you say the one place you dared not look,
right,
is the pew containing your mother and your father and
my wife, yeah. I wanted to make sure that the speech was one in which I was able to deliver the message without being too emotional. During the speech, I'd looked out and I saw these servicemen crying, you know, so I'm going, oh my goodness, I better focus. And then I realized that the one place that would really cause me to have you know, serious emotions would be watching Lauren and or looking at Lauren, mom and dad. So I didn't.
You finished the speech, you walked back down and you sat in the pew, and as you sat down, I'll never forget it, your dad reached over and just put his hand on your hand.
Yeah, he did. It was a very touching moment. I, you know, I've seen the replay of that, and my recollections are still the same, though. It's like, good going, son, I love you. And it was just an expression of love. It was really powerful.
It was later that day you went to New York City and you went to Ground Zero.
I did.
Just describe the moment to me.
Well, first of all, when we walked, I call it the pit. I mean, it seemed like we're walking into a pit. There was not only soot and kind of grime and gray, but there's water. I mean, it's like you're walking into hell. And I got down to the bottom of the, into the area there, and there was a palpable sense of revenge and anger. And you know, I'm trying to be the comforter. And these guys are looking at me like, are you going to go get these guys or not?
They're calling you George.
That's right. It was just fine. I mean,
not Mr. President.
It was George. Yeah, George, you know. And I believe in justice, not revenge. I was overwhelmed by the, you know, the palpable anger and emotion. And so I got on the rubble.
As we mourn the loss of thousands of our citizens,
saying, listen, we appreciate your service and this, that, and the other. And we can't hear you. And it wasn't kind of a soft we can't hear you. It's we can't hear you.
I can hear you. I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
For many people, George W. Bush became a hero that day. But soon, the question started.
Based on some of the intelligence briefings you had gotten, did you not have any idea who was behind this?
I mean, we all surmised it was Al-Qaeda, but before you make a decision to go find somebody, you want to make sure the intelligence is as good as it can get. And the next couple of days, we heard all kinds of chatter and celebratory talk, and so it became clear it was Al-Qaeda.
Did you ever ask yourself the question, what more could I have done to prevent this from happening?
But we just didn't have any solid intelligence that gave us a warning on this. I mean, we didn't have any intelligence that said get ready, they're going to fly airplanes into New York buildings.
Here's something else from the book. I could never forget what happened to America that day. I would pour my heart and soul into protecting this country, whatever it took. It took two wars.
Yeah.
It took thousands of lives, American lives, billions of dollars. You could say it took Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib and government eavesdropping and waterboarding. Did it take too much?
We didn't have an attack.
There were so many reports, some proved completely false in those hours and days after the attacks of 9/11. There were reports of bombs at national monuments. There were other planes that were supposed to be heading into Washington. There was a threat, apparently, against Air Force One.
Yeah, called Angel, that's right.
And then there's a story in the book that I didn't know about. Dick Cheney comes to you on one of those video lines and he says, Mr. President, we have a problem.
Yeah.
It had never been reported before. A few weeks after 9/11, President Bush, Colin Powell, and Condoleezza Rice were at an economic summit in China when Vice President Cheney and Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley called them to a secure video conference.
Dick says the biodetectors have gone off. We think there's been a botulism toxin attack.
At the White House.
At the White House. And we had all been exposed to it. And had we inhaled it, we could easily be dead. Steve Hadley reported, a very formal, really good man, says, Mr. President, we'll have mice tested soon. And we kind of chuckled and said, well, if the mice are feet up, we're goners, and if they're feet down, we're fine.
So some of the most powerful people in the country are waiting to see if a bunch of lab mice die,
up or
and
down.
If they die, you're dead.
Yeah, that's what it was. And the reason I tell the story is because it's hard for people to remember that right after 9/11, we were inundated with threats, a lot of threats.
He and his staff were desperate for information on those threats. How they chose to get it is one of the most contentious issues of his presidency. One he seemed eager to discuss.
Let's talk about waterboarding.
Okay.
We believe America is going to be attacked again. There's all kinds of intelligence coming in. And one of the high-valued Al-Qaeda operatives was Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, chief operating officer of Al-Qaeda, ordered the attack on 9/11. And they say, he's got information. I said, find out what he knows. And so I said to our team, are the techniques legal? And a legal team says, yes, they are. And I said, use them.
Why is waterboarding legal, in your opinion?
Because the lawyer said it was legal. He said it did not fall within the Anti-Torture Act. I'm not a lawyer. But you got to trust the judgment of people around you, and I do.
You say it's legal, and the lawyers told me.
Yeah.
Critics say that you got the Justice Department to give you the legal guidance and the legal memos that you wanted. Tom Kaine, who was the former Republican co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, said they got legal opinions they wanted from their own people.
He obviously doesn't know. I hope Mr. Kaine reads the book. That's why I've written the book. He can draw whatever conclusion they want. But I will tell you this, using those techniques saved lives. My job was to protect America. And I did.
You talk about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. There's another guy you write about in the book, Abu Zubaydah.
Yeah.
Another high-profile terrorist suspect. He was waterboarded. By the way, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was waterboarded, according to most reports, 183 times. This guy was waterboarded more than 80 times. And you explain that his understanding of Islam was that he had to resist interrogation up to a certain point, and waterboarding was the technique that allowed him to reach that threshold and fulfill his religious duty and then cooperated. And you have a quote from him. Quote, you must do this for all the brothers.
Yeah.
End quote.
Isn't that interesting?
Abu Zubaydah really went to someone and said you should waterboard all the brothers?
He didn't say that. He said you should give brothers the chance to be able to fulfill their duty. I don't recall him saying you should water. I think that's an assumption in your case.
Yeah, when you must do this for all the brothers. Oh, so to let them get to that threshold.
Yeah, that's how I interpreted it. Look, first of all, we used this technique on three people.
Mm-hmm.
Captured a lot of people and used it on three. We gained valuable information to protect the country, and it was the right thing to do as far as I'm concerned.
So if it's legal, President Bush, then if an American is taken into custody in a foreign country, not necessarily a uniformed
Look,
American.
Look, I'm not going to debate the issue, Matt.
I'm just asking, would it be okay for a foreign country to waterboard an American citizen?
All I ask is that people read the book, and they can reach the same conclusion if they had made the same decision I made or not.
You'd make the same decision again today?
Yeah, I would.
The United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps.
Far less controversial, the decision to invade Afghanistan. At the time, a haven for terrorists, base of operations for Osama bin Laden.
When you were starting the war plans for Afghanistan, I mean, clearly you had enormous public support. Your approval rating after 9/11 went up to something like 90%.
So?
Well, I'm just saying, you had enormous support. What were your fears about Afghanistan when you were developing the war plan?
Yeah, first of all, the decision to enforce new doctrine, which is if you harbor a terrorist, you're equally as guilty as the terrorist, was not that difficult to make. The hard decision is what to do after you have removed the Taliban. Our nation was ill-equipped for nation building.
Could you have ever imagined in 2001 that we'd still be in Afghanistan and still struggling?
I was hopeful that that would not be the case. But I was also mindful, Matt, that, and history tells us, democracies take a while to develop, including our own.
How big a letdown was it for you, President Bush, that we failed to get Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan? According to a lot of reports, we had him almost in our grasp in Tora Bora, and maybe used too few American commandos to get him. What's the truth?
Well, first of all, the truth is I was disappointed, deeply disappointed, and still am. And secondly, I heard all that noise. We would have moved heaven and earth to get him if we'd have known where he was.
And in any case, there was a new war to wage. How and why he decided to invade Iraq next.
Did you personally have any doubt, any shred of doubt about that intelligence?
No, I didn't.
In a conversation, I think over lunch, you had with Dick Cheney in the period of build up to the war in Iraq, he said to you, are you going to take care of this guy or not? First of all, I was surprised by the tone that the vice president would use with you. Was it surprising to you?
No. I mean, we have a very frank relationship, and he would give me his unvarnished advice.
Right, but his comment leads to the question, was Dick Cheney pushing you to go to war with Iraq?
It didn't matter whether he was or not. I am the guy who makes the decisions as to when we move. I was trying to give diplomacy a chance to work, and he might have been saying, let's go. But I said no.
He says he eventually decided to go to war based on Saddam Hussein's defiance and what seemed to be rock-solid intelligence.
On the subject of WMDs, George Tenet famously said it's a slam dunk, the intelligence.
Yes,
the intelligences. So by the time you gave the order to start military operations in Iraq, did you personally have any doubt, any shred of doubt about that intelligence?
No, I didn't. I really didn't.
Not everybody thought you should go to war, though. There were dissenters.
Of course there were.
I
was a dissenting voice. I didn't want to use force.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
On April 9th, 2003, 20 days in combat, and here comes that statue of Saddam Hussein crashing to the ground in Iraq.
Whoa!
Describe your emotion.
It was a exhilarating moment, but it was only a moment. Shortly thereafter, I said, hey, we're not doing any victory dances, because I knew full well the task at hand was going to be very difficult.
And you write in the book, I should have listened to my own advice.
Yeah, because that led into the famous mission accomplished trip.
Yeah. May 1st, 2003, you stood on the deck of that aircraft carrier and you said, you know, to the American people,
major combat operations in Iraq have ended.
And I also went on to say, there's more difficult work ahead. Right. The problem is...
But you stood under that banner and it sent a very strong message.
No question.
Mission accomplished.
No question. It was a mistake.
Yeah, it's one of those times where your words were used against you over and over again.
No, and that happens when you're president. It's and if I had to do it over again, which you don't get to do when you're the president, you know, I'd have said, good going, men and women. Great mission. Or something. I don't know what it is, but...
of mass destruction. That is what this war was about. Saddam Hussein possesses biological and chemical weapons.
The fact that there are weapons there.
You've heard the president say repeatedly that he has chemical and biological weapons.
That Saddam Hussein still has chemical and biological weapons, and he is moving ever closer to developing a nuclear weapon. Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles. It's high-strength aluminum tubes suitable for nuclear weapons production. Thousands of tons of chemical agents. 500 tons of sarin, mustard, and VX nerve agent. Continues to possess and conceal some of the most lethal weapons ever devised. The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
They have weapons of mass destruction. That is what this war was about.
There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
Saddam Hussein is a homicidal dictator who is addicted to weapons of mass destruction.
They have weapons of mass destruction. That is what this war was about.
Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction.
Former Chief Weapons Inspector David Kay said last week, quote, we were all wrong about Saddam's WMD.
By now, the world knows there was a massive intelligence failure in the war on Iraq. President Bush and other countries...
The failure to find Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction has raised serious questions about the legitimacy and legality of the ongoing war in Iraq. But as both American and Iraqi casualties escalate, and as the conflict becomes more chaotic and deadly by the day, debate within the United States continues to focus narrowly on whether American intelligence agencies provided accurate enough information to justify going to war. In the process, a larger question has been all but ignored. If the war was not about weapons of mass destruction, what is it really about?
I keep asking the questions of why and how. Does this incident even have a purpose?
Pursuing this question forces us to consider a different story. It is a story that begins as the Cold War ends. A story about a group of self-identified radical conservatives at the right-wing extreme of the Republican Party. A group of intellectuals and policymakers who saw the fall of the Soviet Union and communism not as an opportunity to scale back America's Cold War military machine, but as an opportunity to build up its size and scale, to use military force more aggressively and unilaterally, to construct a new, unchallenged American empire.
It's this kind of ideology that has grown up
in the wake of the Cold War, propounded quite openly by what we are calling neoconservatives in America, that identifies the United States as a colossus athwart the world, a new Rome, beyond good and evil. We no longer need friends. We don't need international law. Like the old Roman phrase, it doesn't matter whether they love us or not, so long as they fear us.
Repeat after me. I, George Walker Bush, do solemnly.
When George W. Bush took office in 2000, he brought with him some of the most conservative foreign policy voices in the Republican Party. Chief among them were Vice President Dick Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and Deputy Secretary for Defense Paul Wolfowitz, all of whom had served together previously in the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Paul Wolfowitz, in particular, had long been recognized as the intellectual force behind a radical neoconservative fringe of the Republican Party. For years, Wolfowitz had been advancing the idea that the United States should reconsider its commitments to international treaties, international law, and multilateral organizations such as the United Nations.
You know, so this is not just a Republican takeover. This is a very specific wing of the Republican Party. It's neoconservative. It's unilateralist. It doesn't believe in the rule of law. It doesn't believe you have to tell the public the truth.
And I happen to be an extremely arrogant, dangerous group of reactionary statists. They're not conservatives.
They have a political agenda with regards to foreign policy that they had been working on for years and years, and writing about this and saying this is the post-Cold War vision. This is our post-Cold War vision for American power.
Ever since the Cold War ended, there were people who were fuming on the right, thinking, this is the golden opportunity now that Russia's out of the way for America to take over the world. We're not doing anything about it. Those damn liberals, those softheads, are keeping us from doing what is our godly mission.
A radical plan for American military domination first surfaced during the administration of George H.W. Bush. In 1992, Paul Wolfowitz, working in the Department of Defense, was asked to write the first draft of a new national security strategy, a document entitled The Defense Planning Guidance. The most controversial elements of what would later come to be known as the Wolfowitz Doctrine were that the United States should dramatically increase defense spending, that it should be willing to take preemptive military action, and that it should be willing to use military force unilaterally, with or without allies. This new reliance on military force was necessary, according to Wolfowitz, to prevent the emergence of any future or potential rivals to American power, and to secure access to vital resources, especially Persian Gulf oil.
This caused uproar when it was leaked, and the Europeans got upset, and people like Colin Powell and George Herbert Walker Bush, and to some extent even Cheney, said, you know, this is kind of out there, guys. You gotta tone that down. Because, you know, the end of the Cold War is not necessarily a green light for us to go ballistic and, you know, building up our military and pushing countries around using, you know, the sword rather than diplomacy. But these guys never let go of that.
William?
Out of power during the Clinton presidency, Wolfowitz and his colleagues affiliated themselves with a number of influential conservative think tanks. In 2000, they would craft yet another proposed national security strategy, this one published by a right-wing think tank calling itself the Project for the New American Century. At its core, the document revived the Wolfowitz Doctrine. It called on the United States to increase the military budget by up to $100 billion, to deny other nations the use of outer space, and to adopt a more aggressive and unilateral foreign policy that would allow the United States to act offensively and preemptively in the world. The elimination of states like Iraq figured prominently in this grand vision.
They were coming out against the policy of every American president, from Nixon to Clinton to even George Bush in his first year. They wanted to change that.
But even these hardline conservatives knew that the Wolfowitz doctrine was likely too radical to win the support of the foreign policy establishment, their own Republican Party, and the American people. In their defining document, written in September of 2000, a full year before 9/11, they acknowledged that the process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one. Absent, in their own chilling words, some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor. 1 year later, that event would arrive.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
Stretch. Big stretch.
Okay, Mr. President. I know you said there'll be a time for politics, but you've also said you wanted to change the tone of Washington. Howard Dean recently seemed to muse aloud whether you had advanced knowledge of 9/11. Do you agree or disagree with the RNC that this kind of rhetoric borders on political hate speech?
Yeah. Look, there's time for politics. And, you know, it's time for politics. And it's an absurd insinuation.